Hiron says the outlook for Vienna talks on the revival of JCPOA remains unclear due to the U.S. delay in making a political decision. Russia and Ukraine give the conflicting reports about the opening up of humanitarian corridors in Ukrainian cities as the two sides are to hold a new round of talks. Plus, global oil prices soaring to the highest level since the 2008 financial crisis amid concerns about possible U.S. sanctions on Russian oil. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The U.S. delay in making political decisions has thrown the prospect of a deal to restore the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA into uncertainty, and that according to the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said that the priority of the Iranian negotiators is to resolve the outstanding issues that are considered to be Tehran's red lines. The top security official said that a quick arrival at a strong deal requires new initiatives from all parties. Iran and the other remaining parties to JCPOA have been engaged in negotiations in Vienna since last April to restore the deal that was left in tatters after the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Iran says only a handful of differences remain to be settled, and an agreement could be within reach if the other sides do not raise new issues. Tehran says it's not bound by any deadlines and only seeks what it describes as a good deal. Let's go to Vienna, to Palikborg, the venue of those talks. Homan Lesgi is there for us. Homan, what's the latest?
Yes, Behrouz, I'm actually at the UN headquarters now. The IAEA is holding, of course, its Board of Governors session, and Iran is on the agenda. And Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi is expected to have a press conference in about an hour's time from now to give the latest, both with regards to the situation in Ukraine and the concerns he's raised about the situation there, as well as, of course, the issue of Iran's nuclear program and the recent arrangement that was made between Iran and the IAEA when it comes to resolving the outstanding safeguards-related issues. And we know, of course, and as was said by the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, this safeguards-related issue, the questions there that have been raised between Iran and the agency are directly related to the Vienna talks and a possible agreement, because Iran has said that as one of its red lines, it wants this safeguards-related issue to be permanently closed and resolved. So once it comes to implementation of a renewed JCPOA, this will not be used as an excuse, they say, by the other participants. This will not be used as a kind of leverage or pressure tactic to impede implementation or the removal of sanctions in any way or form. And Iranians have made it clear that the timeline that's been outlined between Iran and the agency when it comes to resolving these issues, Mr. Grossi has said before, after he came from Tehran, that he believes that he will be able to give a conclusion on these issues to the board by June. That's probably the time when the Vienna deal, if indeed an agreement is made, is supposed to reach the re-implementation stage. Because now, once they decide and make that announcement that they want to revive the JCPOA and there is going to be a deal, there will be, and we've said this before, a preparation period. And during this time, various actions are going to be taken both by the Iranians, by the others. We need some time for verification, for instance, of sanctions removal, for getting the necessary guarantees, etc. And the expectation, as far as reports go, of course, not officially, is that it could be maybe in the summer when the deal can be effectively implemented. And the intention of Iran and the agency safeguards-related issues also effectively closed by that time. And we do know from the latest report that's been presented to the IAEA board just now today by Mr. Grossi, the case of one of the locations in Iran and the questions that the agency has had on that issue has been put aside now. Mr. Grossi has said that we're now talking about three locations, not four anymore, because one of the locations, any questions that the agency has had, it doesn't have any more. So now we're talking about those three locations and the work that is going to take place between Iran and the IAEA.
Okay, so Homa, are we waiting for this meeting where you are take place? I mean, and then the Iranian foreign minister will be going back to Vienna too, because the IAEA chief, Mr. Garosi, asked Mr. Abin Abdullahian to go back to Vienna as soon as possible to come to a conclusion and sign this deal.
I assume you're talking about the JCPOA deal, am I correct?
That's right.
Yes. Well, the what Mr. Grossi said, you rightly mentioned there, is that in his conversation with Mr. Amir Abdullahian, the Iranian foreign minister made it clear that it is his intention to come to Vienna once they have agreed to announce this decision and to revive the JCPOA. They're not there yet. And up until this point, we're still hearing that there are some issues that still remain to be resolved. Not a lot. Maybe we don't need a lot of time. But this issue, and when we know, of course, I'll quickly refer to this, the demand that the Russians have been making about getting written guarantees from the Americans, maybe this is going to prolong the process a little bit more. So the foreign ministers will come and have announced their decision that they want to come whenever it's ready, whenever the atmosphere here is ready for that announcement to be made.
Okay, I appreciate that. Homa Lezgi, correspondent in Vienna. Now, this is the 12th day of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. Moscow has announced the opening up of humanitarian corridors in some Ukrainian cities, including in capital Kiev. But Ukrainian officials say that the corridors are still not open. Ukraine has slammed the Russian announcement as an immoral stunt, since they only allow those fleeing to exit to Russia or Belarus. The Russian Defense Ministry says it's declaring a regime of silence for humanitarian purposes. The remarks came amid heavy fighting between the two sides, a new assault by pro-Russia forces in the besieged Ukrainian port city of Mariupol, and Russia's downing of some Ukrainian aircraft and drones are among the latest developments. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has asked Western countries for military aircraft and a boycott of Russian oil. Meantime, Russian and Ukrainian delegations arrived in the Belarusian city of Brest for the third round of peace talks. Political commentator Sarah Flanders says the U.S. wants to use the Ukraine crisis as a pretext to impose more sanctions on the Kremlin aimed at weakening Russia. Let's take a listen.
The U.S. is using Ukraine as a way of battering Russia along its 1,200-mile border. The constant use for 8 years of U.S. heavy equipment, U.S. advisors, which are really U.S. troops, but they're, quote, advisors, mercenaries, fascist forces, and Contras. Now they want to escalate that. But they have been doing this for 8 years. And if this war, if they wanted this war to end today, it would end today if the U.S. stopped pumping in all of these millions, billions of dollars of lethal arms, U.S. advisors into the Ukraine. But really, they're doing all of this to make a war on Russia, to block the enormous amount of trade that had developed between Russia and the European Union, and the trade from China and Russia into the European Union. The European Union was the largest investor in Russia. The U.S. wants to break all of this, and they're determined to block it. They're determined to block it through the sanctions, and now they're determined to also block it through a war that will lay ruin to all of Ukraine.
Now, protests have been held in several countries against the Russian military offensive in Ukraine. In the United States, protesters rallied outside the White House, calling for an end to the conflict between Moscow and Kiev. Elsewhere in North America, hundreds of people turned out in the Canadian city of Toronto in support of Ukrainian people. Mexicans also marched through the capital of Mexico City, waving Ukrainian flags and denouncing Russia for its military actions against its western neighbor. A similar protest took place in the Argentinian capital, Buenos Aires. Russia's military offensive against Ukraine has sent traders into a frenzy, with oil prices briefly soaring to the highest level since the 2008 financial crisis. The global oil benchmark Brent crude spiked to above $139 a barrel before easing back to below $130. Energy markets have been rocked in recent days over supply fears, with the U.S. mulling an embargo on Russian oil. U.S. gasoline prices jumped 11% over the past week, the highest since 2008. Other commodities are also seeing a rise. Gold hit a peak of more than $2,000 an ounce in Asian trade, its highest level since September 2020. Stocks in Hong Kong, meanwhile, tumbled more than 3% in the first few minutes of trade on Monday amid concerns among investors. Geopolitical analyst Daniel Patrick Welch joined us from Boston earlier, and we asked him about the impact of soaring energy commodity prices on people's livelihood.
The trouble with the American public is that they don't pay attention until it's too late, and it's going to get very bad. The idea of rising gas prices scares the hell out of Americans because, first of all, so many millions of us are living paycheck to paycheck, and even a small increase, let alone what we're talking, it could go to like $180 a barrel. This will be $5, $6, $7 an hour a gallon gas. This will be absolutely devastating to the economy and to people's day-to-day lives. The trouble is, American planners just never thought there might be a downside to hiring Nazis to launch a holy war on Russia. And then it's like, oh, oops, this boomerang is going to be severe. And the Russians have been working on avoiding the result of these sanctions. You mentioned one at the top, which was try to get around the SWIFT system. FESCO is also, who operates ports, is saying that they will accept payment in yuan for they're conducting a lot of trade in the Far East between Russia and Asian countries. It's just not Eurocentric or Anglocentric anymore. And the U.S., by contrast, has not developed the population, has not prepared anybody, including its economy, for anything. It's all smoke and mirrors.
Outcry has grown over the European Union's comparatively red carpet treatment of Ukrainian refugees after years of appalling treatment toward non-white asylum seekers. Many in France demand that European nations take responsibility for all refugees, and especially for refugee crises which have been fomented by Western violence. From Paris, Rami Mazahri reports.
In a historic and surprising decision, the European Union has decided to give refugees from war the instant right to live within the bloc and freely travel. They also have the right to work. They even now have rights to housing and medical care. There is one catch. This only applies to Ukrainians. These rights are not being extended to refugees from Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Mali, the Central African Republic, or any of the other countries in which Western armed interventions provoked refugee crises. Seemingly no one would begrudge Ukrainian refugees their human rights, but many in France are wondering why they are getting treated totally differently from black, brown, and Muslim asylum seekers.
Apparently, you have to be white and Christian to be treated properly by the European Union. That's the sad reality, and it's totally unacceptable. We cannot discriminate according to religion, nationality, or color, which are all things which we don't choose. What we can choose is to be human and to have solidarity with each other.
Drowning by the dozens in Calais, France. Freezing to death in Poland. Packed into camps in Italy, building steel fences, denying basic sanitation, fear-mongering about refugees election after election. The long-running European refugee crisis has taken a new turn, and yet standard European policy remains mostly unchanged. An outcry is growing for the European Union to extend their unity, and many say their humanity, towards non-white refugees.
We have to receive refugees and give them normal, humane conditions, regardless of what continent they come from. We have seen acts towards refugees on the Polish border, and we can't allow such things to happen in France. The government has to treat all refugees with total equality and with urgent measures like proper lodging.
Many say the open discrimination, which reveals a deep racism and xenophobia, as well as an arrogant hypocrisy, will ultimately stain the European Union around the world and at home. Many in the French media are describing Ukrainian refugees as somehow qualitatively superior to other asylum seekers. However, many hope that the European Union realizes soon that all refugees are equal and deserving of dignity, assistance, and the same rights without discrimination. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Now, Beijing says the friendship between the people of China and Russia is, quote, rock solid. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says prospects for both sides' future cooperation are very vast. The top diplomat said that the two will maintain strategic strength no matter how dangerous the international situation is. The Chinese official also referred to the Ukraine issue and said that Beijing is willing to carry out necessary mediation over the crisis. Wang said that the issues of Taiwan and Ukraine are different, noting that Taiwan has always been a part of China as part of the country's One China policy. Israel has carried out airstrikes on targets near the Syrian capital Damascus, killing two civilians. According to a military source, the attacks also caused some material damage. Air defenses confronted the aggression and hit most of the missiles, and this after reports of explosions in the sky over capital Damascus. Israel regularly conducts missile strikes on Syrian territory. Last month, three Syrian soldiers were killed in a missile attack by the regime on the vicinity of Damascus. The Syrian government has time and again condemned the aggression, asking the United Nations to hold Tel Aviv to account. Iran's Al Alam Arabic News Network says that Facebook has shut down its page in a, quote, clear violation of freedom of the press. Al Alam says its Facebook page, which had some 6 million followers, was shut down without prior notice on Sunday. It says the American company had earlier imposed strict limitations on how the news network could publish its stories. Facebook had suspended Alam's account temporarily over the past years, republishing pictures of Lebanese, Palestinian, and Yemeni resistance movements and covering the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Soleimani. Over the past years, Facebook has also occasionally suspended press TV news, including after it covered post-election violence in the U.S. in January 2021. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Economic Divide.
The Russian military operation in Ukraine has shown the world one thing. Anger Russia and it can cost you. Because that is what the US-led NATO has done. But with pain inflicted, there's pain received. Hi, I'm Omid Roshandel, filling in for Kaveh Taghvai. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at the economic pain that the world will feel, including Russia's economic pain, and how it had pre-planned a scheme to minimize the sanctions blitz on its country. Coming up, In today's program, the Russian military operation against Ukraine has brought some of the worst sanctions from a host of countries, including the U.S., the U.K., and the European Union. Russian banks, financial institutions, some of Putin's inner circle, and technology transfer, to name a few. The world economic impact, energy, commodities, and food prices will see a surge in prices, especially in the European Union. Things like wheat, aluminum, and nickel palladium will be affected, putting into jeopardy a world recovery. Russia's plans to soften the sanctions impact. Plans in the works from years ago, from decreasing its dollar reserve currency and switching it to gold, to its own payment system. Will this be enough to shield it from sanctions, especially from the U.S.?
We've cut off Russia's largest bank, a bank that holds more than one-third of Russia's banking assets by itself, cut it off from the U.S. financial system.
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has reached a critical point.
And today, we're also blocking four more major banks. That means every asset they have in America will be frozen.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defense. And these sanctions will increase Russia's borrowing costs, raise inflation, and gradually erode Russia's industrial base.
These are major sanctions, not only because they are wide-ranging, but because they are not only the United States, but also Europe, the G7 countries, Switzerland, and others have all come together to ally against Russia on a range of issues.
Russia is Europe's main energy supplier. It relies on Russia for much of its energy.
We have to think about the future. Germany will need more gas because domestic production is declining, because we also need more gas-fired power plants.
Oil prices already had surged recently to their highest level since 2014.
The sanctions package that has been announced is very big. Are there more things to come? Yes. We don't know what that looks like. Some of the things that have been held back are sanctions on the oil and gas sector. I think that the West is going to try to continue to hold back on sanctioning the oil and gas sector.
Stock prices dropped after Putin recognized the independence of rebel-held regions of Ukraine.
I guess we're going to see more inflation. And that certainly will have a knock-on effect on the Federal Reserve, on the Federal Reserve policies and central bankers. So we would expect a rise in interest rates.
Well, there's a lot of ways these sanctions are going to affect companies because both Ukraine and Russia are major commodities exporters, metals, wheat, grain, soybeans. So right away, you've already seen there's going to be a spike in prices of certain commodities that are going to become in short supply. It's the old adage of supply and demand.
Sanctions against Russia could also create an environment for close cooperation between countries already under Western sanctions. They include Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and to some extent, China. A closer cooperation between these countries would dent the impact of Western sanctions and ultimately make them futile. China's close ties with Russia is an important factor. Beijing and Russia have signed major energy and industry deals, and China's economic support could help Russia get out of the crisis.
The world economy will not be able to adjust from the impact of this Russian military on Ukraine quickly. Even though much of the social media posts are against Russia, this brings to light the important and deep role that Russia actually plays in the world economy. Joe Biden had this to say 2 days into this crisis. "I spoke with the G7 leaders today, and we are in full agreement. We will limit Russia's ability to be part of the global economy. We will stunt their ability to finance and grow Russia's military. We will impair their ability to compete in a high-tech 21st century economy." Russia has also been building an in-house system since 2014, the last time SWIFT cutoff was threatened, which may mean they are able to temper some of their impact a cutoff would have on its economy. Though it appears most experts still expect the impact will be significant. There has been a lot of discussions around cutting Russia off the SWIFT financial system, but those plans have not happened yet. The in-house system, though, that this person referred to has been in the works for some time. The system is known as SPFS. It is designed to allow financial institutions to communicate between each other, keeping transactions flowing. And it is meant to help reduce the threat of the U.S. government's control through the SWIFT International Payment Network. And then there is the reality that the ones imposing the sanctions have to face, and that is the fact that the effect that they are after may not happen as soon as they would like. Sanctions are a big deal, experts say, but effects could take years. This is what Brian O'Toole has said. He served in the U.S. Department of the Treasury as a senior advisor to the director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which administers and enforces trade and economic sanctions. He said it could take quite a while, even years, for the sanctions to hurt the Russian economy. Now, Paul Ingram is joining us from Cambridge. He is with the Cambridge Center for Study of Existential Risk. Paul, it's good to have you with us. Thank you for joining the program. War has broken out, and a full scale of sanctions is in effect. Russia is a key supplier of not only gas and oil, but also raw materials that keep world's factories running. Now, we know that Europe gets 40% of its gas and 25% of its oil from Russia, and oil prices have also skyrocketed. Germany also stopped the Nord Stream 2. How badly will sanctioning Russia affect Europe, its energy needs, and in turn, its economy, in your opinion?
Europe is so heavily dependent on Russian energy imports that it's very difficult to see them putting full sanctions on Russia. I could be wrong, and you know, could wake up tomorrow and there could be full sanctions. But if there were, it would have a huge impact on European economies. And so I think it depends really on Russian actions over the coming hours and days. Are we seeing Russian actions that nibble off bits of Ukraine? Bits of Ukraine that have not been under control of the government for the last few years in any case, and bits of Ukraine that are pretty much majority Russian. This is deeply unacceptable to European countries, and the manner in which the Russians have been doing this has been deeply unacceptable. But it's not the trigger for all-out conflict. The parallels with 1939 have been deeply misplaced up until now. So if the Russians instead decide that they are indeed intending to invade the whole of Ukraine and occupy it with a major, major invasion, then I think we will see all-out energy sanctions and other sanctions, and this will have a huge impact on European economies. But I suspect that European governments, they've been talking themselves up the last few weeks, and I think it would be difficult for them not to impose these sanctions in the case of an all-out invasion of Ukraine. And they would see this as acceptable damage, the damage to their economies, with the purpose of once and for all confronting Putin and perhaps trying to trigger some kind of a reversal or even an overthrowing of Putin in the Kremlin. Of course, these are very, very high stakes, and I think as a result, there may well be quite serious impacts on the European and indeed the global economy.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I will get back to you later in the program. I'm now joined by Tobias Baumann. He is a historian and expert in German and French constitutional law, joining us from Berlin. Tobias, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the program. Russia is the world's largest exporter of wheat, and together with Ukraine, it accounts for around a quarter of total global exports of wheat. And the sanctions impact from gas, oil, aluminum, palladium, nickel, and wheat will affect a world still struggling to recover from the pandemic, especially the poor. Now, the question is, how will the world economy suffer from this?
Yes, Russian palladium is necessary for memory chips and auto catalysts, Russian titanium for aircraft construction. So Deutsche Bank has stated today that airlines might lose 10% of their stock value. The supply chains will be even further damaged, and hundreds of German companies may be harmed. And we will also face very high inflation. So, of course, U.S. leads us to an economic chaos in Eurasia, which serves the interests of its fracking industry as well as political purposes, because the intense media campaigns in NATO countries have permitted closing the roles, especially regarding Germany and France. Since US and Australia did great harm to Paris in 2021 when they agreed the new AUKUS pact together with UK. Through this agenda-setting process, Washington DC is going to harm another democracy like Tunisia, because Tunisia depends on cheap importation of wheat, and the sanctions might still worsen the tight supply situation and stabilize the Arabic nation. In fact, the US agenda in Eastern Europe follows 20 years of interventions in Middle East and Southern Mediterranean. Now they seem to close this historical NATO war cycle. Remember Kosovo 99, where NATO has set a dangerous precedent in international law, and those who approve this secession cannot denounce Russian actions in the Donbas.
Welcome to our Info News section, where we cover other economic news from around the world. Even though much of the world has been focused on the Russian operations against Ukraine, there has been other major news, like this one. Biden's real challenge is not Russia or China, but poverty in America. This entry said the average American continues to struggle against encroaching poverty, inflation, and lack of future prospects. Moving on, all those promises of tax reforms by the EU, all the news on tax havens, and yet this piece of news shows EU is not serious about it. EU countries fall short of their promises to stop tax havens. It said European ministers updated the EU's list of tax havens. The update added no countries to the blacklist and 10 countries to the gray list. Moving on, a cooperation between France and China is off to a start. France and China have linked up in global infrastructure projects. They have agreed to jointly build 7 infrastructure projects worth over 1.7 billion euros or $1.9 billion in Africa, Southeast Asia, and Eastern Europe. This shows China's transparency while also showing how countries like to team up with China. And finally, it is sad to see that so many people died for greed, in this case, U.S. drug manufacturers. 3 drug distributors agreed to pay a total of up to $19.5 billion over the course of 18 years. The proceeds will go towards thousands of communities across the U.S. that were affected by the abuse of the prescription painkillers.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
There's more than meets the eye when it comes to Russia's military operation against Ukraine. In some respects, it appears that Russia has prepared itself for this scenario. But the effects on U.S. and European economies can be catastrophic. Since the year 2015, Russia has been adding to its gold reserves and has decreased its reliance on the dollar significantly. Until the year 2017, it had $100 billion of U.S. treasuries. But in a matter of just 3 years, it has reduced that amount by 96%. Who's got more to lose, the U.S. or Russia? U.S. Index of Consumer Sentiment shows one perspective. Oil prices have fluctuated upwards, even crossing the $100 per barrel at one point. The U.S. is experiencing its worst inflation in 40 years. If the Fed raises the interest rate, which it will, a recession remains a distinct possibility. Did you know how much the U.S. imports from Russia when it comes to crude oil and petroleum products? Many do not realize that Russia is U.S.'s number three supplier when it comes to oil. This will place a heavy burden on the U.S., which has forced President Biden to order the release of emergency oil reserves. When it comes to commodities, Russia is one of the main suppliers of steel products. Sanctions will surely send commodity prices flying, like steel, nickel, and aluminum. This will surely negatively affect the economies of Europe and the U.S. Wheat, then fertilizer. Russia is a leading supplier of both of these items, which will suffer a price surge due to Russia's military action. When it comes to wheat, it supplies 20% of the world supply, and on ammonia, an item used in fertilizers, it provides 62% of the world supply. Europe will suffer immensely from this to raise food prices even further there. Now, when it comes to Europe's oil and gas, Russia provides 46% and 53% respectively of supplies to Europe. These prices have already surged to levels not seen before. Many European electricity firms have already shut their doors. Electricity prices in Germany have reached their highest level recorded in that country. And finally, JP Morgan has predicted $150 per barrel for oil prices. This would mean possible complete standstill for European and U.S. economies. Natural gas prices in Europe have already climbed 41%, and this spells a great danger for these two economies since inflation will continue to climb. Paul Ingram, he is with Cambridge Center for Study of Existential Risk, rejoins us from Cambridge. Paul, welcome back. Global banks are poised for turmoil as war has broken out, and the West will now hit Russia with a full scale of sanctions. The U.S. and Britain are aiming to throttle Russia's access to foreign capital, to cut it off from the SWIFT network, and to prevent its access to U.S. dollars. But, Paul, things could get complicated for the entire global financial system. Severe economic penalties could disrupt the global trade flow. What is the fallout here, Paul?
So I think what we're seeing a lot of talk about the banking systems imposing significant restrictions on any involvement with Russia, including withdrawal of the Russians from the SWIFT system. We saw this being quite a significant problem for Iran's economy some years ago. And I think if they were to apply this to the Russian system, we would have quite a big impact on Russia. Of course, we'd also have a boomerang effect on European and more broadly global economic activity and international trade. Russia is the source of a significant proportion of oil and gas, as well as wheat and other staples and primary products, and this would impact on restricting supply and increasing the price of these products, affecting particularly the poorer people in Europe and probably more broadly in the global economy. So this is not cost-free, and I think that the European countries are only likely to do this if we are indeed seeing a full-scale invasion of Ukraine rather than nibbling off bits as the Russians did in 2014.
Well, thank you so much. Now, Tobias Baumann, he is a historian and expert in German and French constitutional law, rejoins us from Berlin. Tobias, welcome back. Germany has come out strong against Russia. Now, we know that Europe gets nearly 40% of its gas and around 25% of its oil from Russia. And oil prices have skyrocketed. Germany also stopped the Nord Stream 2. How badly sanctioning Russia will affect Europe and its energy needs and, in turn, its economy?
SWIFT has one thing in common with the European Union. Both are based in Belgium, but controlled from North America. As you have said, it's again US and Great Britain who are trying to browbeat Moscow. This feels like former Cold War, but it is more dangerous. They are even destroying the free global stock market. They want to maintain their privileged position in Western-dominated world order, the AUKUS War Pact, which only briefly caused disgruntlement in the Élysée in Paris, and the mentioned German self-mutilation by sacrificing the strong strategic energy alliance with Russia. Both facts prove that NATO countries seem to reject the new multipolar reality. The NATO states project actually their own colonial win-lose mentality onto the new multipolarity and thereby risk a new world war. So China was right to criticize NATO for its escalation in Ukraine since last weekend. At the end of the day, we need to become aware of the win-win situation that consists in the New Silk Road, whose endpoints are Hamburg and Duisburg in Western Germany, and of its many new jobs all over Eurasia, instead of following the Anglo-Saxon misinformation.
Hello and welcome, I'm Mahdi Abbasyan. There are many economic aspects to Russia's military operation against Ukraine. One of the measures taken against Russia is sanctioning some banks connected to the SWIFT payment system. But could this backfire? According to the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, all Russian banks already subjected to sanctions will be disconnected from SWIFT. The parties that have agreed to implement this are the EU, the UK, Canada, and the US over Russia's special operation to demilitarize Ukraine. So, what is the real impact of some Russian banks being cut off from SWIFT? According to one analyst, it will only slow down the transactions time. So, what is the real impact of some Russian banks being cut off from SWIFT? According to one analyst, it will only slow down the transaction time and will not completely cut off Russia from the system. In order to predict the impact, it is important to assess the number of banks that currently use SWIFT and the size of transactions undertaken through these. According to the Central Bank of Russia, at least 331 banks, both domestic and foreign, are listed as the SPFS system users. So, Russian banks cut off from SWIFT will switch to the financial messaging system of the Russian Central Bank. But this sounds like it needs time to adapt and get the system running and going. Is Russia prepared for this? The Russian Central Bank stated that in 2014, Russia had already initiated a switch to its alternative payment system called SPFS, since these banks are used for cross-border payments. The impact of the sanctions will not be that severe, but there is another unintended consequence as a result of some of these banks disconnecting from SWIFT, and it is the impact on Russian currency, the ruble. Among some of the other effects Russia's withdrawal or disconnect from SWIFT will not have is that it will not pose a threat to domestic transactions. It will actually increase the use of ruble as an international currency and, at the same time, reduces the possibility of destructive rule the West sanctions will have on Russia's economy. Only time will tell where this will lead to, but it surely will not be business as usual with Russia. That does it for this segment. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until the next episode.
The Russian military operation against Ukraine will end at some point, but the economic damage will be felt for a while. This, however, will most definitely push Russia even further east towards China, with closer ties being forged with countries like Iran. But will Europe be able to diversify itself away from Russia? That is one of the key challenges that Europe will be facing. Well, that does it for this edition of Economic Divide.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. سيد عبد الله الموسوي. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And justice is a key element of humans and human rights. And justice itself is made up of different factors. One of the main factors we want to discuss is freedom. Freedom itself is necessary for any society. It is necessary for any system. It is necessary to establish justice itself. The method adopted by the commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, in the matter of politics, rulership, and administration of the state, was based on the principle of the freedom of people. We can see that from the beginning, from day one, when he was elected as the Khalif, as the ruler, he said, I don't want to be a ruler. If you want to choose me as a ruler and a leader, it has to be chosen by the people, all the people, voluntary. It can't be just some people want me and the rest don't. When you guys make up your mind and all of you decide to choose me as your leader, then I will come. That is an important principle applied by Amir al-Mu'mineen. Never have we seen a personality refuses power when it's given to him. And mind you, it wasn't just a simple city that he has to lead. He was leading the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim nation, a very lofty position that a lot of people fought for to gain. We have the lack of Muawiyah, the lack of Talha, the lack of Zubair, because the Muslim world back then was expanding. It expanded all the way to Spain and all the way to China. So it was almost half of the world, if not more, of the known world that we have today. To be a leader of such great country or a city or a system or what have you, it was lofty. It used to make people kill for it. Amir al-Mu'mineen was handed to him and he rejected. He said, the point of me being a leader is that I need to serve the people, right? But people have to choose for themselves. That's a principle he brought forward, that freedom is for the people. Freedom is by the people, and freedom is, obviously, it goes back to them, not to me. And he had an ardent belief in this freedom, which can be observed in all the actions of Amir al-Mu'mineen. When a person takes Amir al-Mu'mineen and dissects his life, he can see that this principle was applied to every action of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Whether he said something, whether he gave orders or prohibited some actions, whether it was a time of war, whether it was a time of peace, or made an appointment of a governor, or whatever manner he treated people or his children, or even in worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. His conduct was based on all these occasions on freedom itself. Even in his own worship, it has to be done based on the fact that he's free and he wants to do it, not because he has to do it. Let us take a short break and we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice and freedom that stems from justice itself. We said that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he had a very simple yet powerful principle that freedom is for the people and people should and shall be free. The question, however, arises as to why the people should be free. Why did Amir al-Mu'mineen emphasize on freedom of the individuals? Why should they be free? And why they should work according to their will and determination? Now, the answer might be simple, and you might give an answer yourself. But reality is against that. If you take this question and try to dissect it and see why is it important? From where did they get the freedom? And what are its limits? According to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, according to Ali, the real cause of this freedom is a human society which must proceed on the path of blessedness and prosperity. So this freedom that he believes in so strongly that he wants to apply, giving people their own free will and determination, it is only because with such freedom, society can proceed. Society can move on the path of righteousness, on the path of happiness, on the path of prosperity. When people's right is taken away from them, when people have no right to choose, when people have no will, when people have no determination to do things of their own, then that definitely will bring society back and bring society down to its knees and push it back to the dark ages. And we can see that even in our modern times, when you see systems and countries and governments who are oppressive, these countries and these systems are very backwards. Where if you look at systems where people have at least some of their rights and have the right to speak, have the right to elect, have the right to do things their own, you see them prosper and move forward. So Amir al-Mu'mineen's vision of trying to give people complete and absolute freedom, obviously with the limitation that people need to know their limits when it comes to freedom, he was looking at society as a whole. He was looking at the ummah and the nation as a whole. He was looking for the betterment of that nation. He was looking for the improvement of that nation. And he says it will not improve unless people have their freedom. Now, the topic and the concept of freedom in Amir al-Mu'mineen's government is a lengthy one. So, inshallah, we'll leave it up to here. And we will continue this discussion and why is it so important that Amir al-Mu'mineen focus on freedom in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala
محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.